Lewis v. Downey.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name...
Got to sit down. Give him a little chance to sit down.
Oh, sorry. May it please the court, my name is Peter Schutzel and I represent Darrell Lewis. Your Honors, this is not the case to expand the exceptional circumstances when prison guards are permitted to use taser on inmates. This court should not embrace the discretional use of force that the district court's opinion allows. And to give a little background, I'll briefly recap the facts. Darrell Lewis was an inmate at the Kankakee County Jerome Combs Detention Center. On January 26, 2006, he was involved in an altercation with another inmate.
Mr. Schutzel, just to be clear, this was pre-trial incarceration?
Excuse me, Mr. Lewis?
Yeah, for Mr. Lewis. Was he in jail awaiting trial, or had he been convicted and was just incarcerated in the county detention center afterwards?
I believe that he had been convicted and he was incarcerated at the Kankakee
County. So this is a genuine Eighth Amendment problem, not a pre-trial?
Yes. Shortly after the altercation on the 26th, Mr. Lewis was sent to disciplinary segregation. He was sent there without a hearing. In an act of protest for his placement in disciplinary segregation without a hearing and in an act of protest for the conditions in disciplinary segregation, Mr. Lewis started a hunger strike the day after he was placed
there. Let me go back, because I know he's got a Fourth Amendment claim saying he was deprived of a hearing, so he's also got an Eighth Amendment claim about the conditions?
The 14th Amendment claim is with respect to his placement in disciplinary segregation,
right.
And the Eighth Amendment excessive force claim is with respect to his being shot with a taser.
But not about the conditions. I'm just trying to clarify to make sure it doesn't involve the conditions while he was being held.
General prison.
General prison.
Oh, no.
I just wanted to clarify that. Okay,
right.
Go ahead.
In an act of protest, again, the day after he was placed in disciplinary segregation, he began a hunger strike. On the 11th day of that hunger strike, Mr. Lewis requested to see a nurse because some pre-existing conditions were bothering him. He was denied access to that nurse, and he became upset. He became so upset that he took a bottle of non-prescription Motrin pills that he had been given, and he held them up to the camera so the guards could see it, and he threw them around his cell.
Now, I want to kind of dig in here a little bit, because an important part of your theory is that because the guards knew that he was weakened through this hunger strike and he's lying there on his bed, it was almost, as a matter of law, unreasonable force to use the taser on him. But on the other side of that, he's already moved enough to show the pills to the guards and hurl them around, and the guards certainly have some interest in pills not being thrown all over the place. And I'm sure you would agree that in general, prison authorities have an interest in not only communicating the message, but also in reality keeping control of inmates and not allowing disobedience to go unpunished, because word would spread throughout the prison. They've got to keep discipline there. So I'm concerned that from the point of view of the guards, there's this brief tasing. I'm not saying that's nothing, but it's not the most you could imagine either. How can you say at a minimum that a rational guard wouldn't know that this... how can you say that a rational guard would be positive this was impermissible, I'll put it that way, from the point of view of an immunity concern? The guards are trying to keep control of this guy. He's misbehaving. He's been a problem. Yes, they know he's somewhat weak, but they also know he's been acting up in the cell, and he's not obeying their commands, and so they tase him.
Well, whether the inmate had misbehaved is a different inquiry than what the inmate was doing at the time of the tasing.
Well, but immediately before the tasing is when he throws the pills around, right?
Yes, at the moment he was tased, he was lying on his cell and largely non-responsive.
So he lies down again, but they know that's what summons them to the cell. They know he's just done something, so they might think he's capable of at least responding to their command.
And not responding to his command is not a reason for using a taser on someone. As this court pointed out in Fillmore v. Page, in the absence of a penological purpose, malice is established per se, and that penological purpose has been found to be a threat to the safety and security of the prison or a threat to the safety.
Well, I'm not sure we went that far, and I'm not sure. Was that an unpublished opinion?
Fillmore v. Page?
Yeah.
No.
And so you're saying we can't even put this in context. All we can look at is the fact that he was there on his cot. We can't look at the throwing of pills. That's what you're saying. We can't look at the circumstances around it. And that really becomes crucial, it seems to me, on the qualified immunity issue.
Well, the throwing of pills, I don't think, and at the very least it's a question of fact for a jury to decide, I don't think that the throwing of pills is a threat to the safety and security of the prison or the inmates and guards that are within that prison.
But what it does suggest, though, is that he's capable of movement and action and responsiveness. And my concern is that your theory doesn't acknowledge the prison's interest in having inmates obey reasonable orders from guards, like get up. You know, the guards aren't telling him to stand on his head. The guards are just telling him to get up because they want to take him out of the cell. And I would be very loath to say that prisons don't have an interest in having inmates comply with orders from guards.
Certainly prisons have an interest in having inmates comply with orders. But we don't dispute that. What we dispute is the use of force at this level to comply an order like this.
What would you do as an alternative? Lay hands on him?
Handcuff him? There were three guards, and there was one starved and weakened inmate. They didn't attempt to handcuff the inmate before they shot him with the taser. That's an alternative that I think is pretty reasonable, and it's a much lesser amount of force, particularly when there's no threat of a physical confrontation.
How long did the shock last? What's in the record as to how long it lasted? And also, it was kind of a taser gun with hooks. Is that right?
I don't know that the record was developed on the exact type of taser it was. I believe that the taser shot lasted only for a few seconds.
A few seconds.
Didn't he testify in his deposition that he wasn't really that bothered by it?
Well, he testified during his deposition that he was only shocked, but then he went on in his deposition to testify that it's quite a bit to be shocked, and the lasting effects of that taser shot were significant in that it prolonged and exaggerated some pre-existing conditions that the inmate suffered from.
Well, he alleges that, but I guess maybe at this stage we can.
Some departments that use tasers require the officers who use them to undergo the receiving a taser shot. You know?
Well, I don't know that the officers would claiming that the taser shot was de minimis if they had experienced that taser shot, but I don't know if they've gone through that training.
Were they asked what alternatives were available to them as far as moving him?
I don't know that the record was developed on that issue. The record is somewhat limited due to Mr. Lewis's pro se status at the time this case was before the trial court.
And according to Mr. Lewis, too, he was never warned that he would be shocked if he didn't stand up.
He was not given a warning.
He was not given a warning.
He testified that he was shot with a taser because he failed to respond to an order quickly enough. He was, again, as I mentioned earlier, he was sluggish. He was on the 11th day of a hunger strike, and he was lying on his bed when these three officers approached his cell, ordered him to get up to be handcuffed, and when he didn't respond fast enough, he was shot in the leg with a taser. He was dragged out of his, after he was shot with a taser, then he was handcuffed, and he was dragged on the floor out of his cell so the guards could clean up his cell. In addition, and beyond the absence of a penological purpose for the tasing, evidence was presented to the district court that there was actual malicious intent on the part of Officer Schreffler immediately after this taser attack. And there was testimony at Mr. Lewis's deposition that after he was handcuffed and dragged from his cell, Officer Schreffler attempted to kick him in the face.
Now, I was curious about that because attempted to kick him, and I looked at what I could find in the record, and it sounded like the most he was saying is he could see Officer Schreffler start to kick and then kind of arrest his movement, you know, stop and not carry through with it. And I was worried about that, actually, because I hate to punish the officer for not kicking him. I mean, maybe he was annoyed, but at least he doesn't do anything about it.
Well, I think that the attempted kick in the face is not something that the officer would be punished for, but I think the attempted kick in the face goes to the state of mind and the malicious intent of the officer in the moments immediately preceding when he shot the defendant with the taser.
Well, didn't Lewis say that he cursed Schreffler as he was outside the cell, and that's what the attempted kick incident, I mean, that was, he cursed him. He called him a bitch or something, and then that's when he started the kick motion outside the cell.
I'm not entirely sure about the sequence of the dialogue between them immediately after the taser attack.
The only problem with using that not kick as evidence of intent is it does indirectly. I mean, one of the people sued, and this is a lawsuit in his individual capacity, is Officer Schreffler. And so you would say, well, you know, first the tasing, and then, you know, you were thinking of kicking him and then didn't. It seems to me we have strong policy reasons not to, as I said, not to impose liability of any kind on officers who manage to correct their behavior. I mean, I think we could all agree if he had kicked the guy in the face while he was handcuffed and down and tased, that would be rather strong evidence of excessive force, but it didn't happen.
Well, and I would agree that a kick in the face would be extremely strong evidence of malicious intent. But the question here is whether there is a sufficient question that a jury should be answering. And it's the position of Mr. Lewis that there are significant questions that exist regarding the malicious intent of the guards. First, whether a penological justification for the use of the taser existed in the first place. And again, as this court has found, the absence of that penological justification establishes malice per se. And then directly to the question of whether specific...
Did that case address what Judge Wood has expressed concern, and I have the same too, that is the penological interest in requiring obedience to legitimate orders.
And the obedience with legitimate orders and the use of force to enforce those orders has been found in all cases that my research has revealed. When there's a threat to the safety and security of the inmate, the threat to the safety and security of the prison guards, or a threat to the safety and security of the prison.
We're not, I mean, we could, and I have the same concern, there is an interest in having them obey it. Obey the order.
I would agree that there is an interest in requiring obedience with prison orders, but...
Which, of course, writ large, is quite pertinent to the security of the institution, because if the inmates begin to find out that, you know, when Officer X gives you an order, you can just lip off to him or something, then chaos would ensue pretty quickly, I'm afraid. These are not socially well-adjusted people in prisons.
I believe, however, that if such a position were adopted, that it would be a slippery slope to how prison guards and prisons in general could treat prisoners and claim that we're trying to enforce any order that we want enforced, we can use... We can use force, and it falls under this grand umbrella of...
Well, I mean, I agree with you. That's why there's an objective component to the question about the excessiveness of, you know, alleged excessiveness of force.
And, of course, we have to take your client's statement of facts that he was only told once, unlike what the guards say, but we have to accept that he was only told once in that taser, right?
Told once about...
Getting up.
Correct.
Yeah.
moving along, there is also a significant...
You're getting into your rebuttal time if you...
Right.
Okay.
And with that, I'll conclude. We ask that this court reverse and remand the case back to the district court for a determination that the actions of the guard in tasing Mr. Lewis was done without a penological justification, therefore establishing malicious intent per se, and also that a question of fact exists regarding the malicious intent of the guards during the tasing. So that'll be seated.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bersani.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. It's the defendant's position in this case, Your Honors, that summary judgment should be affirmed because the undisputed facts in the summary judgment record demonstrate that Officer Schreffler used the taser in a good faith effort to maintain and restore discipline and ensure inmate and officer safety, and not for any malicious or sadistic reason.
It seems like the policy at this detention center, though, is kind of tase first, ask questions later. Is there no duty to assess the situation at all when you see somebody who we have to accept in these facts? Officer Schreffler knew that he'd been on a hunger strike. He's lying on his bunk. Yes, he's throwing the pills around, but why is a taser a weapon of first resort as opposed to at least second or third?
Well, of course, an officer always has to assess the circumstances presented at the time, but these circumstances, unfortunately, aren't as we're looking at them today, in the comfort of this courtroom. It's a rapidly evolving situation at the time, and what that officer faced at that time, Your Honor, was an inmate who had held up a bottle of pills, didn't get what he wanted.
Was he standing up, does the record show, in order for this, I guess, is there some camera or something that
yes,
focuses in the cell?
There's an intercom system, and then there's a glass wall that can be seen in, so the inmate can be monitored from the correctional officer from the outside.
So did he have to be standing up when he waves the bottle of pills around?
Not necessarily, no.
He might have been sitting in his
It's possible, yes. I don't think that was developed by the record.
I mean, it'd be interesting to know, because if he were really just sort of propped up in his bed for a second and then whooshes the pills around, that makes it seem that he isn't really able to move too well.
But from the perspective of the officers, though, Your Honor, he has a bottle of pills. He wants to see a nurse. Now, he had already refused medical treatment a number of times prior to this. He was told by another correctional officer that you're not going to see a nurse right now. That's what he testified to. We have to accept that for the record. He then got mad because he didn't get what he wanted, so he threw the pills against the wall. And as Your Honor pointed out, he was well enough to do that. And so, according to Mr. Lewis, he was laying in bed. Now, he did say to the correctional officer at that time, "I'll just take care of the pain myself," which was an implied suicide threat. Now, Corporal Woods, who was the supervising officer at that time, was advised by the correctional officer who had observed the conduct that Lewis was yelling and screaming, and that he had pills and he was going to ingest them. So that's the knowledge that Corporal Woods had at the time that he brought both Officer Schreffler and Ayala into the cell. And that's the situation that they faced. When they came into the cell, Officer Schreffler had the taser in hand. So obviously, Mr. Lewis saw the taser, and he knew that if he didn't comply with an order, the taser might be deployed.
But he was not warned. He was not told that.
Well, that is a disputed fact. Although
you have to assume he wasn't
right.
told that.
Right.
You have to assume, although he never denied that, Your Honor, in his deposition. What he said was, look, I was laying in bed. They came in, and before I knew it, they tased me. Mm-hmm. That's not a denial that Officer Schreffler didn't warn him.
But
even if we assume that he didn't,
and
that's fine, Your Honor, we can assume or we can infer that he wasn't warned by, but he was told to get up off the bed. And he didn't get up off the bed.
Yeah, the only reason I wanted that clarified, because you were trying to imply because he saw the taser, I just wanted to, I mean, according to him, nothing was told. He wasn't warned.
That's an inference you can draw from the record if you're going to view the facts in his favor, yes. But it's undisputed in the record that he did not get up. He did not comply with the order. And this court said in Soto versus Dickey, when an inmate refuses an order, some means must be used to compel compliance, such as chemical agent or physical force. Now, Your Honor asked the question, you know, at what point in the continuum does the taser fall? That's the discretion of the officer. And I think that's
not completely. I mean, he couldn't have taken a gun and shot him in the leg.
Of course not. No, I'm not talking about a gun. I'm talking about whether he's going to use it.
I'm just saying all these things. You think he could have, you know, fired some mace in his eyes? I mean, what? There's got to be a proportionality.
And there was here. It was a brief taser shock. It was a couple of seconds. And if you look at that in the context of the lack of any physical injury, and I'm not saying that as a taser shot is not initially painful, but there's no physical injury alleged here at all. And that is a factor that the courts consider
but
in determining.
Counts. I mean,
I'm sorry, Judge?
I mean, I don't know that you want to go there. I mean, they deliberately inflict pain on him. And just because the pain doesn't give him a lifelong, you know, physical injury doesn't. Tell me very much, I guess. I can think of all sorts of ways you can inflict pain without lifelong injury.
Well, in both the Whitley case, U.S. Supreme Court case, and the can't think of the other U.S. Supreme the Hudson case, both indicated that while you don't need Hudson indicated you don't need a serious injury, also indicated that the lack of an injury was relevant to the determination as to whether the officers went too far and acted with a malicious or sadistic purpose. So the lack of an injury is certainly relevant here. And there's no medical evidence of any injury at all that Mr. Lewis suffered. In fact, when counsel points to the grievances and sick call slips, for example, in the record that Mr. Lewis submitted, when you look at those, what Mr. Lewis is complaining about is weakness and dizziness from his hunger strike, which was a voluntary act on his part.
There's a dispute of fact there. I mean, Mr. Lewis, who's not a medical expert, I mean, I'm not going to push this too far, but he thinks that there is a long-term effect. And, of course, if you get into, you know, psychiatric electroshock treatment and other sorts of things, there are effects on the body that last from a big jolt of electricity going through. We don't know. I mean, it seems to me there are questions about that.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think on this record, there's no question that all we have to go on is the evidence that he presented or the lack of evidence that he presented on summary judgment, and he presented none. He complained of his temporary shocking, and that's it. Anything else was related to his hunger strike. In fact, when he talks about a knee injury and a back injury, he was just examined for the knee injury just about a week earlier, and the nurse found nothing wrong with his knee. He was x-rayed. His back was x-rayed in December. And they found nothing wrong with his back. 2 days prior to this incident, he had refused treatment on both February 2nd and on February 5th. He asked for treatment on February 6th, the day of the incident, and he refused treatment then, and then he refused treatment the next day. Those are all indications that he didn't suffer any adverse medical effects or physical effects from this brief, very brief taser shot.
Does the county have any protocol with regard to, is there a state protocol with regard to how long you'll let somebody go on a hunger strike before you intervene?
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor. I'm not. I think what's important in the record here, in addition to the factors that we just described, is there is absolutely no evidence in the record that Officer Schreffler acted with a sadistic or malicious motive. Now, counsel had indicated that, on the one hand, while not responding to command is no reason to use a taser, implying that there's not a legitimate penological interest. On the other hand, counsel conceded that there is an interest in having orders obeyed. Well, they can't have it both ways. And as this court said in Soto versus Dickey, orders are meant to be obeyed, and when they're not obeyed, there is a legitimate penological interest in using some level of force. I cite the case of Caldwell versus Moore, and that was a taser case. Now, it's another circuit, but it's a very, very good discussion about the use of tasers in prisons. And that court said that the use of a taser was not unreasonable to avoid even greater force. So these officers having to react to something that's rapidly evolving, knowing that this inmate was a violent inmate who had fought inmates before and had fought correctional officers just 10, 11 days earlier, they had to make a decision. Do we go hands-on and try and get this inmate off the bed, or do we use what would be a less dangerous measure of force, which would
so
be the taser.
So then asking him a second time to get up would have been risky in your view? Because from Lewis's perspective, he says he was just asked to get up once.
Right. It might be, Your Honor.
So to ask him to wait a minute or so and then ask him again?
And just say, Mr. Lewis,
yeah,
if you don't get up, we're going to tase you or something.
I mean, I mean, I guess I want to know what the imminent threat was to them, because I don't think there's anything in the record that he threatened them or he moved aggressively toward them when he asked for them to get up, right? And most of these taser cases have some sense of aggression immediately to the officers.
Some, but not all. I mean, there were a couple of unpublished decisions by this court, the Dye versus Lohman case, and I know I'm not supposed to, it's a pre-2007 case, but that case did involve the use of a taser on a merely disobedient inmate who was lying in his bed and banging his head against the wall. Now, you can compare that with this inmate who threw a bottle of pills all
right,
over herself.
Right, but then that banging his head against the wall, I think they're able to intervene. That was, he was causing injury to himself.
Your Honor, I think that there has to be an element of discretion for correctional officers to act at the moment. And yes, could they have asked him 2, 3, 10 times, 12 times, 100 times to get off the bed?
Well, no, I wasn't asking about 100 times. I was asking about a second
twice.
Time.
They could have done that. But their discretion at that moment, given that this inmate's violent tendencies in the past, was not to take the chance and to compel obedience to their order by using a brief taser shock. In fact, Soto versus Dickey talks about inmates. There was a group of plaintiffs in that case, and they talk about inmates refusing to come to the cell door. And that case involved tear gas or mace. And this court said, basically, we're gonna let those decisions be made in the hands of the correctional officials who are in a much better position to make those types of decisions, how they're going to keep and restore order within their jails.
Is there anything in this record that talks about the level of the electric shock, and can you adjust the taser to be more powerful or less powerful?
No, there's nothing in the record on that, Your Honor. I am aware of some studies by the Department of Justice, for example, last year, where they found that there was no medical, there was no conclusive evidence that the use of a taser causes any adverse medical problems, and that came out in June of last year. If Your Honor wants to take judicial notice of that and look at that, but not on this record, there isn't any. I think by the fact that the plaintiff has not demonstrated any actual injury as a result of the taser use here may answer your question. We get into the issue of qualified immunity. I think I still have time here.
Well, before you get to that,
sure.
So can you get to the waiver question? Because on his 14th Amendment claim, he filed it in his complaint, and you responded to it in the answer. And so we're not in a situation where he's raised an entirely new claim at the summary judgment stage. We just have a situation where the court didn't address it.
The court didn't address it, and so we litigated those claims that the court said were viable and should be litigated. And that's what we went on. Yes, we did answer an allegation in the complaint, but that did not override the court's merit review order, which was that only the claims related to the lack of medical treatment and the excessive force claims should be litigated. So I think there was a waiver to some extent, because when you review that merit review transcript, the plaintiff did not mention his 14th Amendment claim at all. And it's a pretty lengthy transcript, and the judge gave him quite a bit of time to describe all his claims, and he didn't do that. Beyond that, Your Honor, even if you consider that claim here today as being properly before this court, I would say that 39 days being placed in administrative segregation is not actionable. It doesn't create a liberty interest under the 14th Amendment as this court has described it. And I cite there's a recent case that this court just decided, Marion versus Columbia Correctional Institution. Now, that case involved 240 days in its segregation. However, there is a...
In that case, we said we needed further proceedings to see...
In that case, you did. But that case also talked about instances where the amount of time in segregation without a hearing was so limited and so insignificant that there wasn't a need for further inquiry into the conditions of confinement. And cited, for example, Townsend versus Fuchs, which was 59 days in segregation, Hoskins, which was 60 days, Leckis versus Briley, another Seventh Circuit case, which was 90 days, Thomas versus Ramos, which was 70 days. All those cases fall in line with what we have here. In fact, it's even less than those cases, 39 days. So it would be our position that there's not a liberty interest created here based upon this convicted a felon who was going off to prison anyway for an extended period of time.
So he'd already been convicted.
He'd already been convicted. If you look at, he was actually a federal inmate being housed in Kankakee.
That was what I was going to ask. He was a federal inmate.
Right. He was a federal inmate. He was convicted in November of 2005. He was sentenced in August of 2006. So at the time all these incidents occurred, he was a convicted inmate. I believe
he was awaiting transfer to federal prison.
He hadn't been sentenced yet.
He hadn't been sentenced yet.
So there is actually no final judgment yet, but he's been convicted.
He's been convicted, right. Your Honor, we ask that this court affirm summary judgment, not only based upon the underlying constitutional claim here, but also on a qualified immunity basis. And if this court entertains the 14th Amendment claim, to find that that claim did not state a cause of action. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Schutzel. You have 1 minute, Mr. Schutzel.
I'll just briefly touch on a few things. First, and I think it's been highlighted significantly, I think there are far too many questions of fact that exist in this case. And for that reason, I think the case should be sent back down to the district court for further development of the record. Whether an injury occurred as a result of the taser attack, I believe that's a question of fact. Mr. Lewis claims that he was injured as a result of the taser attack. Whether the prison guards at the time had a legitimate suicide concern, we believe the evidence belies that suggestion, in that the prison guards never sought any medical attention for Mr. Lewis after they thought he ingested all of these pills. Instead, they tased him, handcuffed him, cleaned the cell up, and put him back. He never once saw a nurse or any other kind of medical treatment after these guards purportedly thought that he had ingested quite a few of these pills. Quite simply, we think that there are too many questions of fact here for the judgment of the district court to be affirmed.
And was one of those other facts the Scheffler said that he ordered him three times to stand up to be handcuffed?
Yes. I see that my time is up. So
did you take is this a court-appointed case or a pro bono case?
Pro bono case, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the case will be taken under advisement.